So we have a relatively tumor-heavy set of articles for discussion this morning. And then hopefully if we have a little bit of time at the end, I wanted to touch on a couple of the discussion and notation articles I think that are definitely worth a read. Everything is in Dropbox, and I'm actually going to turn off my camera here. I always get distracted seeing myself in the camera. So we're going to get started with Dr. Buckner's article on hyalur fat invasion as a poorly defined and inconsistently interpreted lung carcinoma staging parameter. So like I said, I'm super glad Dr. Buckner is here. So hopefully I won't mangle this too poorly as I go through it, because I think and I picked this article because I think it's really important to focus on sometimes what we might think as the mundane, but is very important in staging of our lung cancer cases. So,
Is this our partner? Because I thought she spells her name with one T.
oh, is this not ours? It could just be a typo, because on the paper it's just one T.
Okay.
So that might just be a typo in the Word file. Is this yours, Kelly? Are you there? This is your paper, right? She may have logged in and walked away to get some coffee, which I don't blame her. Okay. So I picked this because I think it's important to pay attention to these elements in the templates as we stage our lung carcinoma patients. So there are several different non-size-based parameters that will increase the T category for tumors that are less than or equal to 3 centimeters from the PT1 to PT2A. So, the visceral pleural invasion, main bronchus involvement, I think those are all readily identifiable, although there's some back and forth about what constitutes visceral pleural invasion. And so, certainly, that's a discussion for another time. But there are some other features as well that I think are less well known. Hi, Kelly. I'm talking about your article. This is your article, right? There's a little bit of discussion if yours or not. Awesome.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Excellent. So, if I mangle it, please correct me. So there are others, including invasion into the hyalur fat and direct invasion of adjacent lobe, that are listed in a table of situations beyond kind of what the standard descriptions. And so there was a survey that went out that probably most, if not all of us on the journal club filled out. And the survey asked a couple of questions. One, just what type of practice you're in. What is hyalur fat? How do you identify this? And then how you might approach the PT designation for a lobectomy specimen that's described in a specific way, and then for pneumonectomy specimens. So the first question was, how do you define the hyalur fat? Is any fat outside the lung that is inside the pleural reflection? And so that would include fat around the lobar bronchus and the main bronchus, fat inside the pleural reflection in the vicinity of the hyalur lymph nodes around the main bronchus, and that would exclude fat from around the lobar bronchus, or I have no idea, or other. And about 58% said that any fat outside the lung that is inside the pleural reflection, including the fat around the lobar bronchus and main bronchus, and then 32% fat inside the pleural reflection in the vicinity of the hyalur lymph nodes around the main bronchus, or excluding fat around the lobar bronchus. And then about 10% said that they were admitted that they were uncertain about what this might look like. And then next question was, what would be the best PT designation if you had a right upper lobectomy specimen with a 2.4 centimeter invasive squamous cell carcinoma, so less than or equal to 3 centimeters, directly invades the fat around the lobar bronchus but does not extend beyond the pleural reflection and does not involve the lobar bronchus margin? All right, and then for that particular question, 69% called this a PT1C. And then 23% called it a PT2A, and then 8% were unsure or other. So it's probably about 8 to 10% of the correspondents who are like, I don't know what this survey is. I don't know what's going on here. And then the next question is the best PT designation for a right pneumonectomy specimen. 2.6 centimeter invasive squame in the right upper lobe directly invades the fat around both sides of the lobar and main bronchi, but does not extend beyond the pleural reflection and does not include the main bronchus. And so these were even further split, with 39% calling this a PT1C, and then 48% calling this a PT2A, and then 13% again were unsure. So as you can see, there's no obvious No obvious easy answer. It's not like 90%, 95%, and then and split beyond that. So I think this highlights discordance in the patterns. And so the two most frequent patterns of the discordant responses were the defining the hilar fat as any fat outside the lung, that is inside the pleural reflection, but yet categorizing neither a less than the 3 cm tumor with extrapulmonary fat extension as a PT2A, and then not categorizing as otherwise T1C tumors with invasion of the fat around a main bronchus as PT2A, despite defining this hilar fat surrounding a main bronchus. So it seems like there's a little bit of a disconnect in how you define it and then how you apply that definition. And so, before talking about, recommendations and things, I'm curious, throwing it out to the group of folks that are here, is how do you approach these cases? And did this survey really make you stop and think about hilar facts? I'll say for me, it really did. Any thoughts from the group?
Yeah, I would say it did make me stop and think. And I think like when I answered the survey, I more downstaged it than upstaged it. So I was kind of in the PT1C camp. And I guess maybe, yeah, I just think like if it's just a little bit in the hilar area, I guess want to upstage PT2A. So that was kind of my thought. But I was like, huh, like I really never really thought much about staging with hilar fat until the survey came out, basically. So I thought that was a good question to ask.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it's interesting too, because there's a comment in here talking about, at that hilum where the parietal pleura folds back on itself to become the visceral pleura, you have that boundary between the mediastinum and the lung. And then that pleural reflection, you can see that on histology if you put like elastic stains and things like that. I don't know if I've ever put an elastic stain on anything to look for that in particular. So I thought that was really interesting. And then, of course, you don't have that. You can't use elastic stains to look for the soft tissue around the main bronchus. And so I think then it can be challenging to know what exactly you're looking at. And so occasionally you might just be trying to talk to the surgeon to decide, did you even get, good mediastinal fat? Which with that was resected and what that location might be. And so, the conclusions were that, to ensure that the patients with lung carcinoma extending into the extrapulmonary fat are appropriately staged, it's quite important that we probably put out some additional guidance to be provided as to what constitutes hilar fat invasion, as in addition to the findings that are necessary for invasion of the mediastinal fatty tissue in the immediate vicinity of the main bronchus. And I think it's something similar to what we did for the visceral pleural invasion. Although I'll say we still share cases where we're trying to decide, is this visceral pleural invasion? Is the outer layer the thickest? Did it go through? So those are not uncommonly shared things. So even though it's not super common to have that hilar fat invasion, it's inconsistently interpreted in terms of a staging parameter to affect PT categorization for those tumors that are less than or equal to 3 cm. And we really don't have a good consensus. So maybe that'll be step two of this, is to come up with that and have it incorporated in future iterations. But Dr. Butner, if you wanted to add anything to hopefully my not too mangled description of your lovely survey and subsequent paper.
Thanks first, Yasmin, for selecting it for discussion. And thanks everyone who did participate in the survey. And basically, it's one of those things that it doesn't happen very often, if at all. I think many tumors that invade this area are probably beyond T1 in size anyway. So what I wanted to do mainly was call out that there really is not adequate guidance regarding this parameter. If we're going to have it as a parameter, it either needs to be part of the T2 descriptors and not hidden just in an explanatory note, number one. And then number two is really what is this based on? And I think the data on which this is based are very limited, and does this even deserve to be a staging parameter at all? So I think it bears more thought before just sweeping things into the staging parameters just because they were there before. So I'll just say that.
Yeah, no, that's totally reasonable. Henry.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Yeah, I don't remember how I answered things. It was a while ago, right? But anyway, your point about what data was used to put this in the staging manual. And if nobody knows what it is and all you did was collected, I mean, they used, 10,000 cases or whatever to do the new AJCC. And if there's no agreement on what it is going in, it's garbage in, garbage out. So who knows?
Exactly.
Yeah, and as something that doesn't come up that often anyways. I mean, like I said, before I saw your survey, I was like, gosh, you know, I've seen it and it's in a list of things, but I can't think of ever putting significant amount of efforts in trying to decide, oh, is this Hylar fat invasion or not?
Exactly.
Dr. Kelly.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks, Yasmin. How does this differ from the Hylar bear area?
So where there isn't any pleura, right, is what you're getting at.
Yeah, because that's one of the margins, is the Hylar bear area.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what they're referring to, and that's what I was kind of parsing through the staging guidelines of that little bit of fat that's around the bronchus, that's kind of those couple, that millimeter or two sheath that's inside right. The pleural reflection is, yeah. I think what they're referring to, but again, there is no, believe me, I've scoured the literature. There is no definition as to what is actually being referred to.
Now, there's probably some fat in the hyalur bear area too. So
there's probably inconsistently fat in that area. Yeah, so like for some patients, there might be, and for some patients, there might not be. So again, right. Highlighting the challenges of trying to apply this parameter without good data and without good descriptions. So
you maybe need to correlate it with BMI.
Yeah, that's a good
like
point.
fat yeah. around the heart.
It's visceral fat. Right? It's, some people have more of it than others. Absolutely. Mm. I think it would be
There's
challenging
project,
to gather good
Kelly.
Data. Oh, man.
I don't know. I had our IRB is the length of time between your answering it and other things is inversely proportional to difficulties with IRB on low risk studies. But we'll leave it at that.
Well, thank you so much for putting that out and putting that all in our brains, and I appreciate the discussion on it. All right, so I'm going to move on to our second article. So this is our only, I'm just going to flip my camera off for distraction purposes. This is our second article, is our only non-neoplastic article. So this is from our group, and it's entitled Surgical Pathology of Diffuse Parenchymal Lung Disease in Adults with IgA Vasculitis or IgA Nephropathy. So this was spearheaded by our fellow a couple of years back, Dr. Moore, and I know she put a ton of work in this, and this was also presented at USCAP as well. So IgA vasculitis and IgA nephropathy are two disorders that are thought to be clinically speaking and serologically speaking more and more related, and maybe even representing a spectrum of the same disease process. These are typically pediatric diseases, and pulmonary involvement is relatively rare. And, you know, the histology that you can see in lungs that do have pulmonary involvement has really not been super well described in the literature. And again, relatively rare. So there was, just as a little background, there was a large study that looked at 124 patients. And again, for a case like, for a disease as relatively rare as this is, that's a pretty big study. They found, looking at adults, only 3 of their patients, so like 2%, developed clinically significant pulmonary disease. And they were actually all adults and not not pediatric patients. And so rare to see. And in those patients, 2 had diffuse alveolar hemorrhage and 1 had reported interstitial lung disease, but it wasn't biopsied and they claimed it was UIP and then it resolved with steroids. So probably wasn't UIP, unlikely to meet our current criteria for that. So really not a ton in the literature. So the way this study was done is we looked at IRB approved. We looked at our institutional archives, so a lot of consult cases, as well as our in-house cases and the consultation files. So 10 cases were identified that met the criteria. These are patients that had IgA vasculitis or IgA nephropathy. And actually, those were all extramural consultation cases. So again, sort of already reflecting the consult bias of the study. And so all the patient demographics were looked at and categorized in the tables. I'm not going to go over all of that. You know, clinical presentation, treatment histories, and things like that are all there. So most of these did have renal involvement. Three had renal transplantation. The ones where we did have, we were able to find information on their renal disease, those all had renal biopsy confirmation of their disease. So their respiratory symptoms were relatively nonspecific. You know, a little more than half of them had hemoptysis, not surprising. If you're thinking these patients were already thinking about diffuse alveolar hemorrhage and things like that. Okay, so what was found? So I think not too surprisingly, 80% of the cases did have histologic evidence of diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. Eight of the eight patients with the DAH, two of them had acute DAH with acute fibrinous pneumonitis or DAD with active hemorrhage, you know, including things like fresh blood with fibrin and hemosiderin-laden macrophages. Four cases show DAH in a subacute phase, so more organization with similar evidence that you would expect to see with active hemorrhage. And then two of the cases had just prior DAH evidence, so basically alveolar hemosiderosis with or without that iron incrustation, but no associated acute lung injury or organization. So, of course, that is just reflective of, you know, when you take the biopsies in these patients, when they're in an active flare, are they actively bleeding, and things like that. All right. So of those eight patients with the DAH, six of them had definite or probable capillaritis, all of them who had acute or subacute DAH, and none of those cases actually showed arteritis or phlebitis. So what I think was also interesting is, you know, the changes that were found were not limited to DAH and capillaritis. So five patients, so again, it's a small study, we're working with a relatively small N value, but five patients had a chronic interstitial pneumonia in the background, three with an NSIP pattern, and only two of those had concurrent DAH. So there was one that didn't, and then two with a sort of unclassifiable DAH, and one of those had concurrent DAH. The two patients without the concurrent DAH both presented in an acute on chronic fashion and were found to have organizing pneumonia superimposed on that background fibrosis. So of the three patients that had the NSIP, one had predominantly cellular, one with mixed, and one with fibrotic. So little representation from all. No cases show UIP or a bronchiolocentric or BIP pattern in what we were looking at. There were some lymphoid infiltrates in aggregate seen in over half the cases, and two did have some lymphoid follicles with just one case showing follicular bronchiolitis. So again, you know, the way I think about those types of cases, if you have patients with autoimmune diseases, you might potentially have histologic changes that you might see with autoimmune connective tissue type of process. So diffuse parenchymal lung disease as a broad spectrum is rare but well-recognized complication of IgA vasculitis, with most cases representing DAH and capillaritis. You know, there are some case reports showing this. You can also see this in IgA nephropathy, including in adults. You know, not cases showing a relatively high prevalence, but the data here would support the notion that you can get these complications and they can potentially be fatal. There were some fatalities amongst this patient cohort. You can look in the charts for the details on that. So I think this was it's a small study, but it's the first systematic review detailing the lung pathology seen in adults with IgA vasculitis and nephritis. I think it broadens a little bit of the spectrum of the reported pulmonary manifestations of these disorders to include chronic interstitial pneumonias, including NSIP and an unclassifiable fibrosis. And again, add to the literature highlighting those pathologic similarities between IgA vasculitis and nephritis, kind of further supporting that these may represent the same disease. So, you know, what does this mean for us? Well, you know, keeping in mind that if you see this in the clinical chart, you know, You know, probably if you have DAH, I think, and capillaritis, it's going to be an easier connection to make. You know, if you see the patient has IgA vasculitis or IgA nephropathy, I think that's an easy link to make between those two disease processes. But if you see something more garden variety, organizing pneumonia, NSIP, follicular bronchiolitis, things like that, and you see that the patient does have IgA vasculitis or nephropathy, I think it's worth considering it, even with this sort of small N value here, just to keep it in mind and raise that possibility to the clinicians that in fact, you know, this could be an immune mediated process rather than infection, aspiration, all the other things that you can see with organizing pneumonia. So that was this project. So if anyone has any thoughts, has anyone seen any good cases of this that don't fit the common DAH capillaritis paradigm or things like that, throw it open. I don't know, Henry, if you wanted to add anything on this, you're on this one as well.
Nope, nice summary. And thanks to Brandon, I think, and you for finally pushing it through.
Yes. And thank you to Sam for getting this paper started and doing all the work on it and presenting it at USCAP. All right. Okay, with no other comments, we will move on. So remember IgA vasculitis, IgA nephropathy. Think about potential pulmonary manifestations. All right. So let's see, what do I have up as number three? Okay, so let's move on to looking at small cell subtype markers. So for those of you at PPF, you probably got more detail in this from Dr. Reckman herself. But this paper in HistoPath looked at small cell lung carcinoma subtype markers. So ASCL1, NeuroD1, POW2F3, YAP1. In addition to DLL3, OTP, and TTF1 in 300 lung carcinoids, 300 lung carcinoids and enteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So as we have probably all heard in various talks over the last few years, there are some new transcriptional subtypes of small cell lung carcinoma, ASCL1, NeuroD1, POW2F3, and YAP1. A DLL3 is regulated by ASCL1 and is actually a target of novel therapeutic agents in various neuroendocrine neoplasms. And the point of this study was essentially to look at some of these markers in lung carcinoids because their expression and what that might mean and how it might help out is not well delineated in the literature. Like I said, this came from Dr. Rettman and from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Okay, so they examined 109 lung carcinoids, and they compared that to 191 enteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, and they looked at all of these lung carcinoid tumors. So let's see, what do I want to do here? Okay, so I think understanding the distribution of these markers in neuroendocrine tumors across the organ systems can be useful. Because I think oftentimes, you know, we get small biopsies. Is it a MET? Is it primary? Is it carcinoid? Is it small cell? Is it large cell? So this is a common diagnostic conundrum that we come into. Okay, so let's see. So I did want to mention, so they think they're approaching organ-associated markers for neuroendocrine tumors to include for the lung, OTP, and TTF1. And actually, I wanted to stop there and actually ask the group, how many people use OTP as an organ-associated marker for lung neuroendocrine tumors? I'm just really curious, because it's not something that I have used.
I do. And there are papers out that it's really good in comparison to GI and pancreatobiliary and also to thymus, because the TTF1 is not. It will be expressed in both. And I'm curious, what's the TTF1 clone we are talking about here?
Oh, good question. Let's see what TTF1 clone they used. I actually don't recall seeing it listed.
Oh, don't worry.
Yeah, because I remember I had that thought when I was reading the paper, but I actually did not see it. I did not see it listed, so I will apologize to Dr. Reckman if it is in here somewhere and I just completely missed it. And then CDX2 and SAPB2 for intestine, and islet1 and PAX6 as a primary pancreatic organ marker. You know, as we know, none of these has perfect sensitivity and specificity, and so I think hence the search for additional markers. And then, you know, of the previous literature that is out there, there is saying, it essentially says there's likely specificity of the ASCL1 and NeuroD1 for lung versus the enteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, respectively. But they're really, until this study, hasn't been a super large cohort looking at these. So they did tissue microarrays looking at their cases. So for their neuroendocrine tumors, 85 were typical, 24 were atypical. And all the tumors that they looked at were grades 1 through 2. And they just used our archive of surgically resected specimens at MSK. All right, so they stained all of them with the panel. So the ASCL1, NeuroD1, PAL2F3, YAP1, OTP, TTF1, and DLL3. Okay, so the results for what they received is, so among the 109 lung carcinoids, they found that the ASCL1 and the NeuroD1 were positive in 56% for ASCL1 and the NeuroD1 in 0% of the cases, respectively. The established carcinoid markers, OTP and TTF1, unsurprisingly, positive in 84% and 35% case, respectively, a little bit lower for that TTF1. And then PAL2F3 and YAP1 were negative in all their cases of the lung carcinoids. All right. And then they also mentioned, I thought it was kind of interesting, for OTP and ASCL1 and TTF1, the intracore heterogeneity was relatively low. So in terms of like the heterogeneity of the staining. For the 191 EP NETs, NeuroD1 was positive in 58 and of the PANETs, and then 59% for the small intestine neuroendocrine tumors. And then in contrast to that, the ASCL1 labeled only 2 of the pan-neuroendocrine tumors with low reactivity, whereas all the small intestinal ones were entirely negative. OTP was positive in 1 and none for the small intestine. TTF1, PAL2F3, and YAP1 were negative in all of these cases of the non-lung neuroendocrine tumors. And there's a really nice little picture that I actually put in the summary because I thought that nicely summarized their findings, because there's a lot of markers and there's a lot of percentages in here. So for the DLL3, it was positive in about half of lung carcinoid tumors, only 7% of the pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, and none of the small intestinal. They did make a point, which I wanted to pull out, looking at whether or not ASCL1 and TTF1 provided value to OTP in assessing carcinoids, neuroendocrine tumors of unknown origin, so questions that does often come up. And they looked at the expression of those markers in OTP-negative lung carcinoids. So both ASCL1 and TTF1 were expressed predominantly in those that were positive for OTP. However, of the 18 OTP-negative carcinoids, 4 of those were ASCL1 positive and 1 was TTF1 positive. So I thought that was kind of interesting. All right, so overall discussion. So the distribution of the subtype markers and the carcinoids and the EP neuroendocrine tumors differed sharply from that in small cell and large cell. So notably, there's the complete absence of the PAL2F3 and the YAP1 expression in the carcinoids. And then secondly, the ASCL1 and NeuroD1 showed striking site specificity for lung and enteropancreatic origin, respectively. So ASCL1, good marker for lung, NeuroD1, good marker for enteropancreatic. And then similar to that ASCL1, the DLL3 expression was seen primarily in lung carcinoids. You rarely saw it in the EPNETs. And so I think these findings could have therapeutic and diagnostic implications, especially, you know, as new novel therapies come out. So, you know, this is showing this distribution of the subtype markers very different than that what you see in small cell and large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas across the organ systems, which are defined by the dominant ASCL1 and NeuroD1 expression, commonly with co-expression, with minor subsets expressing PAL2F3 and YAP1. For small cell lung carcinoma, ASCL1, NeuroD1, and PAL2F3 have dominant expression in 70%, 15%, and 10%, respectively, for those markers, with the remainder showing that triple immunophenotype. YAP1 is usually negative in small cell, but low expressions can be seen in about a third of cases for small cell. And then YAP is expressed at a higher level in about 40% of pulmonary large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas. So in contrast to those expression profiles in small cell carcinomas and large cell, lung carcinoids, express usually only a single transcription factor. So for the EPs, either ASCL1 or NeuroD1, and then you have POW2F3 and YAP1 being entirely negative in those EPs. And then the complete absence of that YAP1 in carcinoids is in line with that kind of emerging role as the anti-neuroendocrine factor. And then the absence of that POW2F3 staining, they say, suggests that the tumors don't have a relationship with the tough cell origin. So the YAP1 and the thank you. YAP1 and POW2F3 may have that diagnostic utility where the differential diagnosis includes a neuroendocrine tumor and you have that positive YAP1 and POW2F3 as a firm exclusion criteria for other neuroendocrine tumors and carcinoids. And then just for people listening in the chat, Dr. Kelly put in here that it's the 8 G7 TTF1 antibody. So thank you so much for finding that. All right. So, yeah. So then, again, ASCL1 and NeuroD1 are diagnostically useful in differentiating the pulmonary and enteropancreatic origin in the setting of a neuroendocrine tumor of unknown primary. ASCL1 identified a larger subset of OTP-negative carcinoids in contrast to TTF1. And then there seems to be absolute specificity, at least in their cohort, for NeuroD1 for enteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors compared to lung carcinoids, meaning that you could use NeuroD1 as a rule-out marker for lung origin in neuroendocrine tumors of an unknown primary. So there's a lot more very nitty-gritty detail in here, but I think that this is a very helpful and useful paper as we move forward of using these markers, especially as new treatments come out that are associated with these markers. We're going to have to be using them. I wasn't even using OTP. I'm still INSM1 and synaptochromo and a POW2F3 here and there. So clearly, I know I need to, I think, up my carcinoid neuroendocrine game. Andras.
Yeah, Yasmin, did they break down pulmonary carcinoids to central peripheral carcinoids or?
I think they just did it by typical and atypical. I didn't see them breaking it down in location. Let me double check. I don't recall seeing a location. I think it's just the type, whether it's typical or atypical. Have you found a difference when you approach these?
I know as much that there is a difference in TTF1 expression, and I was wondering about the other markers.
Yeah, I didn't see that they made a differentiation for location, but that is an interesting point. They just seem to go with typical versus atypical. Lots of Dr. Kelly.
Oh yeah, come on, Margaret.
Yeah. Margaret.
are these markers available all at Mayo Clinic?
Oh, I'm going to defer to Dr. Roden for that. Anya, I don't know because I several of them I have never ordered, so. Do we have
Yes, we do have them. We have the ASCL1, we have the NeuroD1, the DLL3, and the OTP. But I have to say, since the clinicians don't ask for them right now, and no one orders NeuroD1, I guess, for instance, I'm not sure for how long we will have them because the lab usually obsoletes things that are not used. And I was thinking the clinician would actually ask for these, but at least ours don't.
That's so interesting. Yeah, maybe it's coming just in time for us to take the stains out of our staining catalog. You had your hand up, Anya. Do you have? Did you have another comment you wanted to add on this one?
For TTF1. According to my old study, published in 2003 or something, TTF1 positive tumor typically with the same clone tend to be peripheral and interestingly tumorless, whereas a central kind of around, those carcinoid you see either typical or atypical, they tend to be negative. But since the sensitivity improved with this, so sometimes you see the positivity in those round cells, but back then only on the more spindle cell or peripheral and the tumorless, those were the TTF1 positive carcinoids.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Sorry, Anya, did you have something else you wanted to add?
Yeah, thanks for presenting this paper. I think it's very useful, even if we just use it for how to distinguish pulmonary from GI. If that was one of their aims, did they discuss CDX2 by any chance? Because I know people use CDX2 for that distinction too.
Yeah, so I think they mentioned it in their discussion as a site specific, but I don't think they actually stained it. It's not in their panel, and they didn't do any data on it. They really were just focusing on these markers. I think they just mentioned as kind of a background, like, oh, this can be a site specific, but I don't see data on this. Although knowing Dr. Rekma, there's data somewhere that she has done, but I didn't see it in this particular paper.
Okay, thank you.
Any other comments on this one? I'm going to be using this as a reference paper. I think this is great to know how these things stain when I inevitably forget how all these various markers stain. All right. Okay, if no other comments, then let's see, how are we doing on time? All right, not too bad. All right, so the last one I had up here for discussion should be relatively quick, and then I was hoping to be able to touch on some of the articles that I have up there for notation. So this was an article that came out of China, Wang et al. They created a risk stratification in stage one invasive non-mucinous lung adenocarcinomas based on high-risk pathologic features. And it's kind of interesting. This paper appealed to me. I kind of went back and forth on whether to discuss it or not, but it appealed to me because it allows us to utilize our histologic findings and our commonly reported data points to actually create a risk stratification model based on it. So what they did in this particular paper is they pulled out what they called high risk features, right? So let's see, where's my little thing here? So they looked at spread through air spaces or STAS, visceral pleural invasion, lymphovascular invasion, and grade three tumors. And they created this multivariate Cox model for disease-free survival. And they actually showed that all four of these are known to be associated with disease-free survival, and they put them into this model, which I don't have the statistical understanding. Maybe if someone else on the call happened to read this and understands the stats here better than me, they can comment on that. But they put in this model, and they showed that with the point system that they created based off of it, that those high-risk features can actually be used to create a residual risk for pathologic stage one non-mucinous invasive lung adenocarcinomas. And I wonder if something like this, especially if it gains traction, would actually be entered into our future iterations of the CAP template. Because, you know, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, the models we use for, like, I don't know, breast cancer, you know, post-treatment, and we put in our features and we get a score out, and that has to do with the outcome prognosis. So I just wanted to put this on folks' radar if this gains traction and we start to see this. It was a multi-center cohort. They put a huge number of patients, a couple hundred, so 373 in their cohort. They had a couple of different hospitals. Now, you know, the challenge to something like this, and I think the potential, you know, challenge of it is how do you apply some of these features, and in particular STAS, I think, because I think we've shown that STAS is not something that we all necessarily report in the same way or can even agree on what is STAS, what is not STAS. I think some of the other features, visceral pleural invasion, is it, you know, grade three, LVI, things like that are a little bit easier. But incorporating STAS, you know, how they used it, how their different institutions used it, how we use it, I think that might be a little challenging and could skew something like this. But certainly something that we may see in the future. So I just wanted to put this one on folks' radar. But I don't know if anyone had any thoughts about this or kind of the value that we can pull out of our own histology outside of just the pathologic staging for it. Might have been a better article for notation, but anyways, that's there, and maybe it'll gain traction. Maybe we'll see it again in the future. Okay, so I in the last 5 minutes, I just wanted to touch on a couple of the articles that I had for notation here that you can see. So one was an article, again, Dr. Tazlars here. This was, you were on this project looking at CDX2 and CK20 to help differentiate benign reactive things in the lung, you know, mucinous metaplasia, reactive changes, things like that, from adenocarcinoma. And it showed that you don't actually see CDX2 and CK20 in these benign reactive processes, and maybe you could use that to differentiate if they're positive in, you know, mucinous adenocarcinomas. And I will say anecdotally, I've been doing this for years, and so it's nice that there's finally some literature out there to support this. Curious, is anyone else doing this? Does anyone else use these things like SAPI2 and things like that? Do you use that to help identify something benign reactive versus it could be tumor?
I don't, but I think this is a really useful little article on a small biopsy when you're debating that very question. So I appreciate a small but mighty takeaway here.
Yeah, I think it's really
learned this tip from Dr. Yi. Dr. Yi taught me that.
Nice. I think it's something a lot of us do, just anecdotally, but it's never been published. So I'm glad to see it out there. Interesting article just saying high prevalence of TSC2 mutations.
Henry, sorry, I was muted.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see.
I mean, so my colleagues were doing this, and Susan Armstrong created a little button for me when she was here that says, "Then show me the paper." It's like, you can't just do this without any data to support it.
Thank you,
Henry. So that's why we did the paper. It's like, if we do it, let's prove that it actually works.
I think it's great.
So, you know, I did a lazy pathway. You know, I never published on that, but I at least took a close look look at in any benign situation, and I've never seen one, so I think that helps.
Yeah, I learned this trick from Max. So we all pick up the tricks, and then I'm glad someone finally got around to publishing it.
Does anyone use Napsin? Does Napsin have any value here at all? Probably not, because if TTF1's negative, Napsin's always negative.
Yeah, that's how I always think about it. You know, it's going to drop Napsin first. And honestly, if I have a tumor that's TTF negative and Napsin positive, I'm worried that it's actually not lung, that it's some GYN tumor or something. That will actually push me away from lung. But yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I've almost never seen the Napsin outperforms the, TTF1. So, and the Napsin always kind of the confuse you with the macrophages, and we get that all the time, you know, from consult, they call it positive, but if you look at it, it's macrophages, you know, so I don't use all that much.
Yeah, same. I rarely use Napsin. There was an interesting abstract from actually JTO, and they had created a novel learning module for automated classification. It was like a deep training learning module for classification of thymomas and thymic carcinomas. And it seems like their model actually performed relatively well for thymic carcinomas versus thymomas. So that was kind of interesting. Let's see, what else did I want to pull out? I did put one article in here in the non-neoplastic notation category, not strictly a histology article, but it was looking at implications of the current administration's environmental policies and how that's affecting lung health and how that will increase disease burden overall. And I think it's a good read for all of us that treat and take care of patients with lung disease, just for awareness. In the reveals and editorials, let's see, there was a really nice, and we're kind of coming right up on the hour, but there was a really nice in memorial for Dr. Wick that I think is worth looking at. And worth looking at that, and I have that in there. And then there was another article looking at a morphomolecular classification of pleural mesotheliomas, which was kind of interesting, maybe a different way to approach the tumor heterogeneity in mesos and how we might classify them based off of that. And then there was a very nice review article looking at challenges and controversies in the diagnosis and management of thymic epithelial tumors from the Thymic Tumor Subcommittee. So shout out to Dr. Roden for that one. And definitely, I think is worth a read. It's a really nice review. Really helpful on that. So, I think that puts us right up at the top of the hour. So thank you to everyone for your engagement. I really appreciate it. And until next time.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.